Chapter 2. It was the beginning of June, and the weather had been unusually fine in Petersburg for a whole week. The Epanchins had a luxurious summer villa of their own at Pavlovsk. Lizaveta Prokofievna became suddenly excited and bestirred herself, and after less than 2 days of bustle, they moved there. 2 or 3 days after they had left, Prince Lyov Nikolaevich Mushkin arrived by a morning train from Moscow. No one met him at the station, but as he got out of the carriage, he suddenly had a vision of strange glowing eyes fixed upon him in the crowd that met the train. When he looked more attentively, he could not discover them again. It could only have been a fancy, but it left an unpleasant impression. And apart from that, Mushkin was sad and thoughtful, and seemed worried about something. The cab drove up to a hotel near Liteyny. The hotel was by no means a good one, and Mushkin took 2 small, dark, and badly furnished rooms in it. He washed and changed his clothes, asked for nothing, and went out hurriedly, as though afraid of losing time or of not finding someone at home. If anyone who had known him 6 months before, on his first arrival in Petersburg, had seen him now, he might well have thought him greatly changed for the better in appearance. Yet this was scarcely true. It was only his dress that was quite different. His clothes were all new, and had been cut by a good Moscow tailor. But there was something wrong even with his clothes. They were rather too fashionable, as clothes always are from conscientious but not very talented tailors, yet worn by a man who was obviously indifferent to his appearance, so that anyone too prone to laughter might perhaps have found something to smile at in Mushkin's appearance. But people will laugh at all sorts of things. Mushkin took a cab and drove to Pesky. He had no difficulty in finding a small wooden house in one of the streets there. To his surprise, it turned out to be a pretty little house, clean, kept in excellent order, and with a front garden full of flowers. The windows on the street were open, and from them came the continuous sound of a harsh voice, as though someone were reading aloud or making a speech. The voice was sometimes interrupted by a chorus of ringing laughter. Mushkin went into the yard, mounted the steps, and asked for Mr. Lebediev.
"He's in there,"
answered the cook who opened the door to him, with her sleeves tucked up to her elbows. She pointed to the drawing-room. The drawing-room had walls covered with dark blue paper, and was furnished neatly with some effort at smartness. That is, it contained a sofa and a round table, a bronze clock under a glass case, a narrow looking-glass on the wall, and a small old-fashioned chandelier, hanging by a bronze chain from the ceiling, and adorned with lustres. In the middle of the room, with his back to the door, stood Mr. Lebediev himself. He was wearing a waistcoat, but had discarded his coat in deference to the weather, and striking himself on the chest, he was declaiming bitterly on some subject. His audience consisted of a boy of 15, with a merry and intelligent face, and a book in his hands. A young girl, about 20, dressed in mourning and carrying a baby in her arms. A girl of 13, also in mourning, who was laughing violently with her mouth wide open. And another very strange-looking figure lying on the sofa. A rather handsome dark lad of 20, with thick long hair, large black eyes, and with just a hint of beard and whiskers on his face. He seemed to be frequently interrupting Lebediev in his harangue and arguing with him, and this, no doubt, was what provoked the laughter of the others.
"Lukian Timofeyitch! Lukian Timofeyitch! I say, look here! Well, botheration take you!"
And waving her hands, the cook went out red with anger. Lebediev looked round, and seeing Mushkin, stood for some time as though thunderstruck. Then he rushed to him with an ingratiating smile, but before he reached him he stood still again, murmuring,
"Illustrious prince!"
But suddenly, as though unable to rise to the position, he turned round and, apropos of nothing, rushed first at the girl in mourning with the baby in her arms, so that she was startled and drew back. But he left her at once and flew at the younger girl, who was standing in the doorway leading into the next room with traces of laughter still on her smiling lips. She was scared by his shout and bolted to the kitchen. Lebediev stamped his feet at her to add to her alarm, but meeting the eye of Mushkin, who looked on embarrassed, he brought out an explanation.
"To show respect."
"There's no need of all this," Mushkin was beginning.
"One minute! One minute! One minute! Like a hurricane!"
and Lebediev vanished quickly from the room. Mushkin looked with surprise at the girl, at the boy, and at the figure on the sofa. They were all laughing. Mushkin laughed too.
"He's going to put his coat on," said the boy.
"How annoying," Mushkin said. "And I expected... tell me, is he..."
"You think he's drunk?" cried a voice from the sofa.
"Not a bit of it. 3 or 4 glasses, 5 perhaps. But what's that? The regular thing."
Mushkin turned to the voice from the sofa, but the girl began speaking, and with the most candid air on her charming face, she said,
"He never drinks in the morning. If you come to see him on business, you'd better speak to him now. It's the best time. When he comes back in the evening, he is sometimes drunk, though now he more often cries in the evening and reads the Bible to us. But it's only 5 weeks since..."
"He ran away because it was half for him to answer you," laughed the young man on the sofa. "I'll bet anything that he's cheating you already, and is hatching something now."
"Only 5 weeks. Only 5 weeks,"
Lebediev said, coming back with his coat on, blinking and pulling his handkerchief out of his pocket to wipe his tears.
"We are alone in the world."
"But why have you come in all in rags?" said the girl. "Why, behind the door there lies your new coat. Didn't you see it?"
"Hold your tongue, dragonfly,"
Lebediev shouted at her.
"Oh, you..."
He stamped his feet at her, but this time she only laughed.
"Why are you trying to frighten me? I'm not Tanya. I shall not run away."
"But you will wake Lubotshka and frighten her into convulsions. What's the use of shouting?"
"God forbid! Don't say such a thing!"
Lebediev was terribly alarmed all at once, and flying up to the baby, who was asleep in his daughter's arms, made the sign of the cross over it several times with a frightened face.
"God save and preserve her! That's my baby daughter, Lubov," he added, addressing Mushkin. "Born in most lawful wedlock of my newly departed wife, Eleanor, who died in childbirth. And this is my daughter, Vera, in mourning. And that... Oh, dear." "What? He can't go on?"
cried the young man.
"Go on, don't be shy." "Your Excellency," Lebediev cried with a sort of rush, "have you read in the papers of the murder of the Zhemarin family?"
"Yes," answered Mushkin with some surprise.
"Well, that's the actual murderer of the Zhemarin family. There he is."
"What do you mean?" said Mushkin.
"That is, allegorically speaking, the future second murderer of a future Zhemarin family, if such there be. He is preparing himself for it."
Everybody laughed. It occurred to Mushkin that Lebediev really might be playing the fool, because he foresaw the questions he would ask, and not knowing what answer to make, was trying to gain time.
"He's a rebel! He's plotting!"
shouted Lebediev, as though unable to restrain himself.
"Tell me, can I? Have I the right to recognise such a foul-mouthed fellow, such a strumpet, so to speak, and monster as my own nephew, the only son of my deceased sister, Anisia?"
"Oh, shut up, you drunken fellow.
Would you believe it, Prince? He's going in for being a lawyer now. Pleads cases in the court. He's become so eloquent, he talks in high-flown language to his children at home. He made a speech before the Justices of Peace 5 days ago. And whom do you think he defended? Not a poor woman who begged and besought him to, who had been robbed by a rascally moneylender of 500 roubles, all she had in the world, but that very moneylender, a Jew called Zeidler, just because he promised him 50 roubles.
50 roubles if I won the case, only 5 if I lost it,"
Lebediev explained suddenly, in quite a different tone, as though he'd not been shouting at all.
"Well, he made a fool of himself, of course. Things are different nowadays. They only laughed at him. But he was awfully pleased with himself.
'Remember, O judges, who are no respecters of persons,' says he, 'that a sorrowful, bedridden old man, living by his honest toil, is losing his last crust of bread. Remember the wise words of the lawgiver. Let mercy prevail in the court.'
And would you believe it? He says over that very speech to us here every morning, word for word, just as he spoke it. Just before you came in, he was reading it for the 5th time. He was so pleased with it. He's licking his lips over it. And now he wants to defend someone else. You are Prince Mushkin, I believe. Kolya told me he had never met anyone cleverer than you in the world."
Yes, yes, and there is no one cleverer in the world,"
Lebediev chimed in at once.
"Well, he's lying, we know. Kolya loves you, but this man wants to make up to you. But I don't intend to flatter you at all, let me assure you. You have some sense. Judge between him and me. Would you like the prince to judge between us?"
He addressed himself to his uncle.
"I'm glad you've turned up, Prince, indeed."
Yes, cried Lebedev resolutely, and he unconsciously looked round at the audience, which began to gather about him again.
Why?
What is it? Asked Mushkin, frowning a little.
His head ached, and he felt more and more convinced that Lebedev was cheating him and glad to gain time.
This is the statement of the case. I am his nephew. That was not a lie, though he is always lying. I haven't finished my studies, but I mean to, and I will, for I have character. Meanwhile, I've taken a job on the railway at 25 roubles a month. I admit, moreover, that he has helped me two or three times. I had 20 roubles, and I lost them. Would you believe it, Prince? I was so low, so base, that I lost them gambling.
To a wretch! A wretch whom you ought not to have paid! Shouted Lebedev.
Yes, to a wretch, but whom I ought to have paid, the young man went on. That he is a wretch, I'll bear witness to, and not because he beat me. He's an officer who has been turned out of the army, Prince, a discharged lieutenant, one of Rogozhin's crew, and he teaches boxing. They're all scattered now since Rogozhin got rid of them, but the worst of it is that I knew he was a wretch, a scoundrel and a thief, and yet I sat down to play with him. And when I'd lost my last rouble, we were playing palki, I thought to myself, if I lose, I'll go to my uncle, Lukyan, and bow down to him. He won't refuse me. That was low. Yeah, that was really low. That was conscious meanness.
Yes, that was certainly conscious meanness, repeated Lebedev.
Well, don't crow over me. Wait a bit,
his nephew shouted testily.
He's only too pleased.
I came here to him, Prince, and owned up. I acted honourably. I did not spare myself. I abused myself before him all I could. All here are witnesses. In order to take that job in the railway, it is necessary for me to have some sort of a rig out, for I'm in absolute rags. Just look at my boots. I couldn't turn up like that, and if I don't turn up at the proper time, someone else will get the job, and then I shall be stranded again. And when should I get another chance?
Now, I'm only asking him for 15 roubles, and I promise that I will never ask him for anything else again. And what's more, before the end of the first 3 months, I'll pay him back every farthing of it. I'll keep my word. I could live on bread and kvass for months together, for I have plenty of will. I shall get 75 roubles for 3 months. With what I borrowed before, I shall owe him 35, so I shall have enough to pay him. Let him fix what interest he likes, damn him. Doesn't he know me? Ask him, Prince, when he has helped me before, haven't I paid him back? Why won't he help me now? He's angry because I paid that lieutenant. There's no other reason. You see what he is. A regular dog in the manger.
And he won't go away, cried Lebedev. He lies here and won't go away.
I told you so. I won't go till you give it me. You're smiling, Prince. You seem to think I'm in the wrong.
I am not smiling, but to my thinking, you certainly are rather in the wrong,
Mushkin answered unwillingly.
Say straight out that I'm altogether wrong. Don't shuffle. What do you mean by rather?
If you like, you are altogether wrong.
If I like? That's absurd. Don't you suppose that I don't know myself that it's rather a doubtful line to take? That it's his money, it's for him to decide, and it's an act of violence on my part? But you know nothing much of life, Prince. There's no good in sparing men like him a lesson. They need a lesson. My conscience is clear. On my conscience, he will be none the worse for it. I shall pay him back with interest. He's got moral satisfaction out of it, too. He's seen my humiliation. What more does he want? What's the use of him if he doesn't help people? Look at what he does himself. Ask him how he treats others and how he takes people in. How did he manage to buy this house, eh? I'll bet you anything he has cheated you before now, and is already scheming to cheat you again. You smile. Don't you believe it?
It seems to me that all this hasn't much to do with your business, observed Mushkin.
I've been lying here for the last 3 days, and what goings-on I've seen,
cried the young man, not heeding.
Would you believe it? He suspects that angel, that motherless girl there, my cousin and his daughter, and every night he searches her room for lovers. He comes in here on the sly and peeps under my sofa, too. He's crazy with suspiciousness. He sees thieves in every corner. He jumps up every minute in the night, looking at the windows to see if they're properly fastened, trying the doors, peeping into the oven.
and he'll do this half a dozen times in the night. At the court, he defends robbers, but he gets up three times in the night to say his prayers on his knees here in the drawing room and bangs his forehead on the floor for half an hour at a time. And what prayers for everyone! What pious lamentations when he's drunk! He prayed for the rest of the soul of the Countess du Barry. I've heard it with my own ears. Collier heard it too. He's perfectly cracked. Do you see? Do you hear how he slanders me, Prince? Cried Lebediev, flushing and really angry. And he doesn't know that, drunken and degraded swindler and beggar though I may be, my one good deed was that I wrapped that grinning rascal in his swaddling clothes when he was a baby and washed him in his bath, and sat up without a wink of sleep for nights together with my widowed sister, Anicia, when she was penniless and I was as poor as she. Attended them when they were sick, stole wood from the porter downstairs, used to sing and crack my fingers at him with an empty belly. And this is what my nursing has come to. Here he lies laughing at me now. What business is it of yours if I really did cross myself once for the soul of the Countess du Barry? 3 days ago, I read the story of her life for the first time in the dictionary. Do you know what she was, du Barry? Tell me, do you know or not?
Oh, of course nobody knows but you,
the young man muttered sarcastically but unwillingly.
She was a countess who rose from shame to a position like a queen's, and to whom a great empress wrote in her own handwriting, ma cousine, a cardinal, a papal legate at a levée du roi. You do know what a levée du roi was. Himself offered to put the silk stockings on her bare legs, and even thought it an honour. A lofty and sacred personage like that. Do you know that? I see from your face you don't. Well, and how did she die? Answer, if you know.
Get away with you. Don't pester me.
The way she died after such honours was that the hangman, Samson, dragged this great lady guiltless to the guillotine for the diversion of Parisian poissarde. And she was in such terror she didn't know what was happening to her. She saw he was bending her neck down under the knife and kicking her while the people laughed, and she felt her screaming, Encore! Au moment! Monsieur le bourreau! Encore au moment! Which means, wait one little minute, Mr. Borrow, only one! And perhaps for the sake of that prayer, God will forgive her. For one cannot imagine a greater misere for a human soul than that. Do you know the meaning of the word misere? Well, that's what misere is. When I read about that countess's cry for one little minute, I felt as though my heart had been pinched with a pair of tongs. And what is it to a worm like you if I did, when I was going to bed, think of mentioning that sinful woman in my prayers? And perhaps the reason I mentioned her was that, ever since the beginning of the world, probably no one has crossed himself for her sake, or even thought of doing so. And it may be pleasant for her to feel in the other world that there is a sinner like herself who has uttered at least one prayer on earth for her. Why are you laughing? Don't you believe, atheist? How do you know? And you told a lie, if you did hear me. I didn't only pray for the Countess du Barry. My prayer was this. Lord, give rest to the soul of that great sinner, the Countess du Barry, and all like her. And that's quite a different matter, for there are many such sinful women, examples of the mutability of fortune, who have suffered much and are storm-tossed yonder, moaning and waiting. And I prayed then for you, and people like you, insolent and overbearing, since you troubled to listen to my prayers.
Oh, that's enough! Shut up!
Pray for whom you like, damn you, only stop your screaming!
The nephew interrupted with vexation.
He is mightily well-read, you see. You didn't know it, did you, Prince?
He added with an awkward grin.
He's always reading books and memoirs of that sort.
Your uncle is anyway not a heartless man, Mushkin observed reluctantly. He was beginning to feel a great aversion for the young man.
Why, he'll be quite puffed up if you praise him like that. Look, he's licking his lips already with his hand on his heart and his mouth pursed up. He's not heartless, perhaps, but he is a rogue, and that's the trouble. And he's a drunkard besides. He's all to pieces, as a man who's been drinking a good many years always is.
That's why nothing goes smoothly with him.
He loves his children, I admit. He respected my late aunt. He even loves me, and has left me a share in his will, you know. I won't leave you anything,
cried Lebediev furiously. Listen, Lebediev, said Mushkin firmly, turning away from the young man.
I know by experience that you can be a businesslike man when you choose. I have very little time now, and if you... Oh, excuse me, what is your name and your patronymic? I've forgotten. Timofey and Lukianovich. Everyone in the room laughed again.
A lie! Cried the nephew. He's lying even about that. His name is not Timofey Lukianovich, Prince, but Lukian Timofeyevich. Come, why did you tell a lie? Isn't it just the same to you if it's Lukian or Timofey? And what does it matter to the Prince?
He tells lies simply from habit, I assure you.
Can that be true? Asked Mushkin impatiently.
Lukian Timofeyevich, it really is, Lebedev admitted, overcome with confusion, dropping his eyes humbly and again putting his hand on his heart.
But why on earth, then, did you say that?
To humble myself, whispered Lebedev,
bending his head lower and more humbly.
Oh, what nonsense. If only I knew where to find Kolya now, said Mushkin,
and turned to go away.
I'll tell you where Kolya is,
the young man put himself forward again.
No! No, no!
Lebedev flared up and flew into great excitement.
Kolya slept here, but in the morning he went out to look for his father, whom you, Prince, have brought out of prison. God only knows why. The General promised yesterday to come here to sleep, but he hasn't come. Most likely he slept in the hotel, the Pair of Scales, close by. Kolya's probably there, or in Pavlovsk, at the Epanchins. He had the money, he meant to go yesterday, so he's probably at the Scales, or at Pavlovsk.
He is at Pavlovsk, at Pavlovsk. Let us go this way into the garden, and have some coffee.
And Lebedev took Mushkin's hand and led him away. They went out of the room, crossed the little yard, and went through a gate. Here there was a very tiny and charming garden, in which, owing to the fine season, all the trees were already in leaf. Lebedev made Mushkin sit down on a green wooden seat by a green table fixed in the ground, and seated himself facing him. A minute later, coffee was brought. Mushkin did not refuse it. Lebedev still looked eagerly and obsequiously into his face.
"I didn't know you had such an establishment," said Mushkin, with the air of a man thinking of something quite different.
"We are orphans," Lebedev began, wriggling, but he stopped short.
Mushkin looked absently before him, and had no doubt forgotten his remark. A minute passed. Lebedev watched him and waited.
"Well," said Mushkin, seeming to wake up.
"Ah, yes. You know yourself, Lebedev, what our business is. I have come in response to your letter. Speak."
Lebedev was confused, tried to say something, but only stuttered. No words came. Mushkin waited and smiled mournfully.
"I think I understand you perfectly, Lukian Timofeyevich. You probably did not expect me, and you thought I shouldn't come back from the wilds at your first message, and you wrote to clear your conscience. And here I've come. Come, give it up. Don't deceive me.
Give up serving two masters.
Rogojin has been here for 3 weeks. I know everything. Have you succeeded in selling her to him, as you did last time? Tell me the truth."
"The monster found out of himself. Of himself."
"Don't abuse him. He's treated you badly, of course."
"He beat me. He nearly did for me,"
Lebedev interrupted with tremendous heat.
"He set his dog on me in Moscow. It was after me the whole length of the street. A hunting bitch, a fearsome beast."
"You take me for a child, Lebedev. Tell me seriously. Has she left him now, in Moscow?"
"Seriously? Seriously? Gave him the slip on the very day of the wedding again. He was counting the minutes while she made off here to Petersburg and straight to me. Save me, protect me, Lukian, and don't tell the prince. She's even more afraid of you, prince. There's something mysterious about it."
And Lebedev slyly put his finger to his forehead.
"And now you have brought them together again?"
"Most illustrious prince, how could I? How could I prevent it?"
"Well, that's enough. I'll find out for myself.
Only tell me, where is she now? With him?"
"Oh, no, not at all. She is still by herself. I am free, she says, and you know, Prince, she insists strongly on that. I am still perfectly free, she says. She is still living at my sister-in-law's, as I wrote to you.
And is she there now?
Yes, unless she is at Pavlovsk, as the weather is so fine, at Darya Alexeyevna's villa. I'm still perfectly free, she says. She was boasting only yesterday of her freedom to Nikolay Ardalionovitch. A bad sign.
And Lebediev grinned.
Is Kolya often with her?
He is a heedless, unaccountable fellow. He doesn't keep things secret.
Is it long since you have been there?
Every day. Every day.
Then you were there yesterday?
No, 3 days ago.
What a pity you've been drinking, Lebediev. Or I might have asked you something.
Oh, no, not a bit of it. Lebediev positively pricked up his ears.
Tell me, how did you leave her?
Searching.
Searching?
As though she were always searching for something. As though she had lost something. She is sick at the thought of the marriage and looks upon it as an insult. She thinks no more of him than of a bit of orange peel. Yes, she does, though, for she thinks of him with fear and trembling. She won't hear his name, even, and they don't meet if it can be helped. And he feels it only too well. But there's no getting out of it. She is restless, sarcastic, double-tongued, violent. Yes, violent, for she almost pulled my hair last time after one conversation. I tried to bring her round with the apocalypse.
What do you say? Mushkin asked, thinking he'd not heard him rightly.
By reading the apocalypse. She's a lady with a restless imagination. And I've noticed, too, that she has a great partiality for serious subjects, however remote they may be. She likes such talk. She likes it and takes it as a mark of special respect. Yes, I'm a great hand at interpreting the apocalypse. I've been interpreting it for the last 15 years. She agreed with me that we are living in the age of the third horse, the black one, and the rider who has the balance in his hand, seeing that everything in the present age is weighed in the scales and by agreement, and people are seeking for nothing but their rights. A measure of wheat for a penny, and 3 measures of barley for a penny. And yet they want to keep a free spirit and a pure heart, and a sound body, and all the gifts of God. But by rights alone, they won't keep them. And afterwards will follow the pale horse, and he whose name was Death, and with whom hell followed. We talk about that when we meet, and it's had a great effect on her.
Do you believe that yourself? Asked Mushkin, scanning Lebediev with a strange expression.
I believe it, and explain it so. I am naked and a beggar, and an atom in the vortex of humanity. No one respects Lebediev. He is fair game for everyone's wit, and they are all ready to give him a kick. But in interpreting revelation, I am equal to the foremost in the land, for I am clever at it. And a grand gentleman trembled before me, sitting in his armchair as he took it in. His illustrious excellency, Niall Alexeyevich, sent for me the year before last, just before Easter, when I was serving in his department, and purposely sent Pyotr Saharich to fetch me from the office to his study. And he asked me, when we were alone, "Is it true that you expound Antichrist?" And I made no secret of it. "I do," said I. I explained and interpreted, and did not soften down the horror, but intentionally increased it, as I unfolded the allegory and fitted dates to it. And he laughed, but he began trembling at the dates and correspondences, and asked me to close the book and go away. He rewarded me at Easter, but the week after he gave up his soul to God.
How so, Lebediev?
He did. He fell out of his carriage after dinner, knocked his head against a post, and on the spot he passed away like a babe. A little babe. 73 years old he was. He had a red face, grey hair, and was sprinkled all over with scent. And he was always smiling. Smiling like a child. Then Pyotr Zaharich remembered. "You foretold it," he said.
Mushkin began getting up. Lebediev was surprised and positively puzzled at his moving.
"You don't take much interest in things now,"
he ventured to observe obsequiously. "I really don't feel quite well. My head is heavy from the journey, perhaps," answered Mushkin, frowning.
"You ought to be out of town,"
Lebediev hazarded timidly. Mushkin stood pondering.
"In another 3 days I'm going out of town with all my family for the sake of my newborn nestling, and to have this house done up. We're going to Pavlovsk, too.
You are going to Pavlovsk, too? Asked Mushkin suddenly. How is it everyone here is going to Pavlovsk? And you have a villa of your own there, you say?
Not everyone is going to Pavlovsk. Ivan Petrovich Titsin has let me have one of the villas he has bought up cheap. It's nice and high up, and green, and cheap, and bon ton, and musical. And that's why everyone goes to Pavlovsk. I'm living in a little lodge, however, and the villa itself is...
Let?
No, not quite.
Let it to me, Mushkin proposed suddenly. That seemed to be all Lebedev had been working up to. The idea had entered his head 3 minutes before, and yet he had no need of a tenant, for he already had found someone who had told him he might perhaps take the villa. Lebedev knew for a fact that it was not a question of perhaps, and that he certainly would take the villa. But now he was struck by the idea, likely by his reckoning to be a profitable one, that he might let the villa to Mushkin, taking advantage of the fact that the previous tenant had not been quite definite. A regular coincidence and quite a new turn of affairs rose before his imagination suddenly. He received Mushkin's proposition with enthusiasm, and at his direct question as to terms, he simply waved his hands.
"Well, as you like. I'll make inquiries. You shan't be a loser."
They were both coming out of the garden.
"And I could, if you liked, I could tell you something very interesting, highly honoured prince, relating to the same subject," muttered Lebedev, wriggling gleefully on one side of the prince.
Mushkin stopped.
"Darya Alexeyevna has a villa at Pavlovsk, too."
"Well?"
"And a certain person is a friend of hers, and evidently intends to visit her frequently there, with an object."
"Well?"
"Aglaya Ivanova."
"Oh, that's enough, Lebedev," Mushkin interrupted, with an unpleasant sensation, as though he had been touched on a tender spot.
"All that's a mistake. I'd rather you'd tell me when you are moving. The sooner the better for me, as I'm at a hotel."
As they talked, they had left the garden, and without going back into the house, crossed the yard and reached the gate.
"Well, what could be better?" Lebedev suggested at last. "Come straight here to me from the hotel today, and the day after tomorrow we will all move to Pavlovsk together."
"I'll see," said Mushkin thoughtfully, and he went out at the gate. Lebedev looked after him. He was struck by Mushkin's sudden absent-mindedness. He had forgotten even to say goodbye as he went out. He did not even nod, which seemed out of keeping with what Lebedev knew of Mushkin's graciousness and courtesy.